Welcome to the Deep Drive. This is the Federal News Update for Friday, November 21st, 2025.
And it's great to be here. I'm Sam Kennedy.
And I'm Alex Johnson. Today, we have a really specific and, frankly, an astonishing mission.
We certainly do.
We're doing a comprehensive, granular deep dive into every single action and activity of the U.S. federal government since the beginning of November 20th, 2025.
And this 48-hour window, it's not just a collection of random headlines.
No, not at all. What we're seeing is a stunning display of a coordinated multi-front strategy. It's impacting governance, foreign policy, constitutional law,
and the internal function of the federal workforce all at the same time. That coordination, I think, is the defining characteristic here.
I agree.
We're seeing this maximum acceleration of the administration's mandate for disruption. I mean, they're challenging judicial authority, reversing decades of climate and energy policy, and deploying these really assertive transactional foreign policy instruments all at once.
So for you, the listener, understanding these 2 days gives you the essential blueprint for what the rest of the year is probably going to look like.
It's the playbook.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately. We should start where the institutional friction is the highest. Washington, D.C. The biggest legal headline of the 20th was this major constitutional showdown.
It's huge.
It's all about the domestic deployment of military forces.
Yes, and this is a textbook clash. I mean, it's executive power versus judicial limits playing out in real time. U.S. District Judge Gia M. Cobb issued a preliminary injunction, a massive decision,
right,
ordering the Trump administration to halt the indefinite deployment of National Guard troops to D.C. immediately.
Okay, so the administration has consistently argued that the president, as commander-in-chief, has this, you know, inherent power to do this. What was the fatal flaw in their argument, according to Judge Cobb?
Well, the court just fundamentally rejected this idea of a free-floating presidential power. Judge Cobb's ruling was very clear. It asserted that the administration had, and I'm quoting here, exceeded the bounds of its statutory authority.
So it wasn't a constitutional question as much as a statutory one.
Exactly. The core legal analysis rested on the Home Rule Act of 1973. And, you know, while Congress keeps the ultimate legislative authority over D.C., they delegated significant policing and governance authority to the locally elected government.
To Mayor Muriel Bowser and the D.C. Council?
Precisely. So by deploying military troops for what are basically routine policing functions, you know, crime deterrence, patrolling Union Station, without D.C.'s explicit consent, the administration violated that act.
So she's drawing a very clear line here. She's arguing that the moment a military force is used as what, an auxiliary police force on domestic soil?
Yes.
The president has to have specific statutory authorization, or there has to be a genuine, verifiable insurrection.
That's it, exactly. The ruling stated that the president has no free-floating Article II power to deploy the military for routine crime deterrence. The administration, you know, they tried to argue this was necessary because of rising crime rates, but the judge found that the current situation just didn't meet that emergency threshold needed to override local sovereignty.
And these troops were acting as a kind of permanent fixture, right?
Right. A permanent, non-responsive augmentation to the Metropolitan Police Department.
Now, this issue gets a lot more nuanced when we talk about where these troops are actually from, because the administration hasn't just been using the D.C. National Guard.
No, and this is where the federal and state tension becomes really acute. They've been pulling in forces from outside the district. We're talking about roughly 1,500 troops sourced from other states.
Notably West Virginia.
West Virginia, right. Deployed under what's called Title 32 status.
Okay, and just to clarify, Title 32 means they're federally funded, but they're still under the command of their state governors.
You've got it. And Judge Cobb specifically ruled on this point. She said that state governors, like West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey, they just don't have the authority to order their Title 32 units into D.C. when the local government has not requested mutual aid.
Wow. That's a huge clarification of the constitutional boundaries.
It is.
She's effectively saying that the federal executive can't just use governors as a workaround to deploy a military police presence into a city that has explicitly said no.
Exactly. This legal maneuver strikes right at the heart of the administration's strategy, which seems to be creating a kind of standing federal military police force that operates domestically.
Which violates the spirit of the Posse Comitatus Act.
It absolutely does. This effort forces the locally elected D.C. government to share police powers with commanders who don't answer to them. They answer to external political figures. That is a dangerous precedent for local governance everywhere.
Okay, here's the rub, though, and this is the part that's so confusing. Despite this really clear judicial finding that the deployment is unlawful, the troops are still on the streets. How is that possible?
That is the strategic brilliance of the 21-day legal limbo. Judge Cobb granted a 21-day stay on her own injunction.
Why?
Well, her justification was practical. She said that immediately pulling 2,500 troops could cause, quote, potential disruption in the city. But, and this is the key part, this 21-day window is a critical gift to the Department of Justice.
It gives them time to appeal.
It gives them time to immediately appeal the decision up to the D.C. Circuit and, you know, likely request an emergency stay from the Supreme Court. So the troops, even though they've been declared unlawful, they remain fully operational.
Still acting as deputized special U.S. Marshals.
Correct, while the administration just plays the appeals clock.
And we know this D.C. case isn't happening in a vacuum. The administration is running a multi-front legal campaign all over the country to establish this broad presidential authority.
That's the key context. You have to see the bigger picture. The D.C. ruling landed at the same time the administration was filing its final briefs in Trump v. Illinois.
A case that's pending on the Supreme Court's very volatile shadow docket.
Exactly. And that Illinois case is about the governor suing to block a threatened federal deployment to Chicago. The Supreme Court's decision there in Trump v. Illinois, that's going to be a controlling precedent.
So if the court grants the executive broad discretion, Judge Cobb's ruling in D.C. could just be wiped out.
It could be nullified instantly.
Right.
If the court says the president can define what constitutes impediments to the execution of the laws, then this entire detailed ruling becomes moot.
And at the very same time, we have a completely different outcome over in the Ninth Circuit's jurisdiction.
Right. A total contradiction. A federal judge in Portland, Oregon, issued a permanent injunction, not temporary, permanent, barring troops from that city, asserting that the federal actions there were just clearly illegal.
And the administration has appealed that.
Of course. So you have this divergence, a temporary stay in D.C., a permanent ban in Oregon, and this massive case pending before the Supreme Court. It illustrates what experts are calling the chaotic and unsettled nature of constitutional law on this issue right now.
And the administration just leveraging that chaos.
They're using the appellate process to keep the deployments in place while they aggressively hunt for that one big win at the high court that gives them the permanent legal framework they want.
That's a perfect segue from judicial friction to, well, political friction.
Mm-hmm.
Moving from the courtroom drama, let's look at the incredibly charged executive rhetoric and legislative engagement that really defined November 20th and 21st.
The rhetoric, it hit what many people consider an unprecedented fever pitch. President Trump publicly demanded the arrest, trial, and execution.
And he was specific.
He was very specific, mentioning the death penalty and being hanged for six Democratic House and Senate members.
And this threat wasn't made in a vacuum. It was a direct response to a video those six lawmakers released.
It was. And all six of them are military or intelligence veterans, which is a key detail. In the video, they urge service members to defy any illegal orders.
The administration framed that video as seditious behavior. They called the lawmakers traitors.
They did. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, she went to great lengths to defend the president's extreme rhetoric. She argued that the Democrats were actively conspiring to encourage active duty service members to defy the chain of command, which she called a very dangerous thing.
So she's saying their words could incite violence.
Her argument was that it could inspire chaos and it could incite violence within the military structure itself.
It's a classic rhetorical inversion. The White House is arguing the lawmakers, by questioning the legality of orders, are the ones threatening instability, not the president, for demanding they be executed.
Exactly. And the Democrats' core argument, you know, it's rooted in military law. Every service member takes an oath to the Constitution, not to a person. Refusing an illegal order is mandatory.
But the White House position is that the commander-in-chief's orders are, by definition, legal.
Leavitt basically asserted that the commander-in-chief operates solely within the bounds of the law, which makes the question of an illegal order irrelevant. And suggesting otherwise is what's dangerous to unit cohesion.
The political fallout shows just how deep this divide is.
It does. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called the threat outrageous. But notably, Republican Congressman Mike Lawler said that both the Democrats' video and the president's call for the death penalty were fundamentally wrong.
So he's calling for a de-escalation from both sides.
He is. He argued that the rhetoric needed to be toned down before it incites real violence, which just shows how difficult it is for anyone in Congress to navigate this extreme political environment.
Speaking of high-stakes political spectacle, we had that highly anticipated Oval Office meeting. It was scheduled for Friday, November 21st.
Right, between President Trump and the New York City mayor-elect, Zohran Mamdani.
This meeting is just pure, unadulterated transactional theater.
It really is. I mean, Mamdani is a Democratic socialist. The White House press secretary, Leavitt, publicly smeared him repeatedly, you know, calling him a communist who was elected by the Democratic Party machine.
But privately, the president's view was different.
Reportedly, yes. Behind closed doors, the president described Mamdani as a talented politician and a good talker.
And that public-private contradiction, that really defines this administration's political style, doesn't it? Condemn your enemies in public, but be ready to negotiate with them if it serves your immediate purpose.
It's the core of the strategy.
So what were the existential stakes for New York City coming into this meeting?
The stakes could not have been higher. Mamdani went to the Oval Office to talk about the affordability crisis and public safety in New York, but the president had issued this dramatic threat.
A threat to pull federal funding.
To pull $9.7 billion in federal funds from New York City if the conversation didn't go the way he wanted.
$9.7 billion. Let's put that in perspective for you. That's approximately 8% of the entire New York City budget.
Losing that overnight would be catastrophic. It would require immediate, drastic cuts to infrastructure, housing, transit, social services, everything.
So it transforms the meeting from a simple political negotiation into an exercise in coercion.
Absolutely. It's a signal that the president is willing to use the federal budget as a weapon to punish or control local political opposition. Mamdani's primary job was just to secure that funding, no matter the political cost or the optics.
It demonstrates that the policy itself is often secondary to the transaction. It's about whether you're willing to accept the terms of executive dominance to save your city's finances.
That's the question he had to answer.
On a completely different legislative note, we saw a rare moment of, well, bipartisan cooperation with the signing of the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
H.R. 4405, yes. The Epstein Files Transparency Act was signed into law by the president. This bill mandates the attorney general to release all unclassified documents related to the Jeffrey Epstein investigation.
And they have to do it quickly.
Within 30 days.
The political irony here is just so deeply layered. The president initially tried to dismiss the whole thing.
He did. He called the bill a Democrat hoax before completely pivoting to sign it, claiming that Republicans had nothing to hide and that the public deserved the full truth.
Well, the Democrats framed the bill as a tool to expose connections to the president himself.
Or to other high-profile figures across the political and financial spectrum. The sheer pressure from public interest groups is really what forced this through.
So what happens now that the clock has started? We're on a 30-day countdown to a potentially massive destabilizing data dump.
We are. And while the DOJ can and certainly will cite ongoing investigations to withhold information, the law is written to try and force transparency. It requires the DOJ to justify every redaction.
And crucially, it requires an index of what's being withheld.
That's the critical part. They have to provide an index of documents containing the names of politically prominent figures that are being withheld. This ensures Congress can keep the DOJ's feet to the fire.
So even if the files are slow-walked, the public will at least know who is being protected.
That's the idea. And this release, it could affect figures in media, finance, and both political parties. It's a ticking time bomb.
Okay, moving from constitutional friction and political drama, let's pivot dramatically to the systematic, coordinated overhaul of the regulatory state.
Right.
This is specifically centered on energy. And this is where we see the administration's mandate operating with maximum velocity.
This section, I think, really represents the engine room of the administration. The Secretary of Energy, Chris Wright, announced a sweeping reorganization designed to prioritize energy dominance and hydrocarbon production over basically all previous climate efforts.
They're calling it the Wright Doctrine.
Informally, yes, that's the name it's getting.
So let's detail the specifics of this restructuring at the Department of Energy, the DOE. Hmm. What was diminished and what was elevated?
The dismantling of the green-focused offices was systematic and thorough. The Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, ER.
Which for decades was the primary funder and driver of climate mitigation research.
It was. And now it has been significantly downgraded and diminished. It no longer holds its prior status. More visibly, the Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations and the Office of State and Community Energy Programs, they appear to be dissolved or just absorbed entirely.
And that signals an end to federal support for a lot of local climate initiatives.
It does. Things like community solar grants, weatherization programs, efficiency efforts that supported local economies, that federal support is gone.
And on the flip side, the promotion of fossil fuels was institutionalized.
Absolutely. The administration elevated hydrocarbons both structurally and symbolically. The old Office of Fossil Energy was rebranded.
It's now the Hydrocarbons and Geothermal Energy Office, HGEO.
Right. And that shift from fossil to hydrocarbons is deliberate. It removes the implicit climate stigma and emphasizes the resources industrial utility.
And the inclusion of geothermal is also strategic, right?
It's key. Its development relies heavily on deep drilling technologies and engineering expertise that overlap extensively with existing oil and gas extraction methods. This basically ensures the oil and gas industry maintains control and expertise over future energy research.
The most consequential move here seems to be the financial power shift within the DOE, the transformation of the Loan Programs Office, the LPO.
This is the financial hammer. The LPO, which, you know, famously financed risky but potentially transformative green tech, like advanced batteries and solar projects, has been transformed into the Office of Energy Dominance Financing, EDF. Its mandate is almost entirely inverted.
So what can the EDF guarantee loans for?
Now, it's now authorized to guarantee loans specifically for projects that add energy to the grid or enhance reliability. The focus is hyper-specific, financing the repowering of retired coal and natural gas plants.
So they're prioritizing dispatchable power sources over intermittent renewables.
That's the explicit goal. And what about the critical mineral side of that mandate? The EDF is also charged with financing critical mineral extraction in the U.S.
But not for green energy.
Not necessarily. This funding is primarily aimed at reducing reliance on Chinese supply chains for minerals essential to defense manufacturing and advanced weaponry. It's another move that fuses energy policy with national security policy.
And this executive reorganization was reinforced by a rapid sequence of legislative deregulation in the House.
Yeah, the coordinated pincer movement. On November 20th, the House passed two pivotal bills. First, H.R. 1949, the Unlocking Our Domestic LNG Potential Act, passed 217-188.
And this is enormous for natural gas exports. Explain how it fundamentally alters the process for liquid natural gas or LNG terminals.
Historically, the Department of Energy had this critical speed bump. It was required to determine if LNG exports were in the public interest before they could be approved.
And that public interest clause allowed past administrations to block new terminals based on environmental concerns.
Or climate impact, or even the potential cost to domestic consumers. H.R. 1949 strips the DOE of that authority completely. It transfers sole approval jurisdiction to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FURC.
And FERC doesn't have the same environmental or macroeconomic mandate, right? Their focus is much narrower.
Exactly. FERC's mandate is about infrastructure siting, safety, and interstate commerce. It doesn't prioritize climate or domestic consumer prices in the same way. By shifting authority, the bill creates this powerful presumption of approval for all future LNG terminals.
So it dramatically speeds up exports.
It does. Supporters argue it depoliticizes the process and boosts U.S. influence. Opponents warn it's a rubber stamp for massive pollution and will drive up domestic energy prices.
And the second bill, H.R. 3109, the Refiner Act, targeted the downstream capacity for petroleum.
This bill, which passed 230-176, is aimed squarely at the supply side. You know, the U.S. hasn't built a major new oil refinery in decades.
Because of regulatory cost and environmental hurdle.
And massive capital risk. The Refiner Act mandates a comprehensive federal review of all regulations that are currently hindering the expansion of refining capacity. The clear intent is to streamline permitting and incentivize new construction.
And at the same time, we saw immediate action on public lands as well.
We did. President Trump signed SJ Res 80, which overturned BLM restrictions on oil leasing in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, immediately unlocking those vast lands for development.
This whole systematic overhaul was then completed with a massive environmental rollback from the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yes. Regarding the definition of waters of the United States, or WTIS, the administration released the proposed updated definition of waters of the United States, which is the direct implementation of the recent Supreme Court decision in Sackett v. EPA.
And this new standard drastically narrows federal jurisdiction. How does this new, narrower standard fundamentally change land use across the country?
Well, it all hinges on this concept of a continuous surface connection. Under the new rule, federal jurisdiction is narrowed to only those wetlands and waterways that have a continuous surface connection to traditional navigable waters.
So think of a permanent river flowing into the ocean.
Right, and only wetlands that are physically, visibly connected to that river system are protected. This definition excludes vast categories of seasonal streams, wetlands separated by berms, and waterways that only flow after it rains.
This sounds like a complete shift of power over water quality from the federal government directly to the states.
It is an enormous power shift. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin framed the previous broader definitions as being weaponized against property owners. The new rule significantly reduces the permitting burden for developers, mining operations, and, critically, industrial agriculture.
It effectively removes federal oversight under the Clean Water Act over millions of acres.
Millions of acres of previously protected wetlands, yes. It speeds up construction and agricultural expansion.
And there were very specific protections written in for the agricultural sector.
Yes, the rule explicitly adds exclusions for prior converted cropland land that was once wetland but has been continuously farmed, and all waste treatment systems. These exclusions further shield the agricultural sector from federal oversight. It completes the trifecta of deregulation we saw in this 48-hour window.
Moving now to international actions. If domestic policy is driven by energy dominance, the foreign policy we saw on November 20th demonstrated a strategy of transactional coercion and maximum pressure. Let's start with Iran.
This was a coordinated financial and diplomatic strike that's being called Maximum Pressure 2.0. The Treasury and State Departments issued joint sanctions against a huge network, 58 entities, individuals, and vessels, all involved in the illicit trade of Iranian oil.
And the goal is simple. Starve the regime of revenue.
Exactly. Starve them of the revenue they need to fund their proxy forces and their nuclear program.
Who were the key targets here?
The targets were surgically chosen to hit the regime's infrastructure. Key targets included Sepur Energy Jahan, a company explicitly identified as a front for the Iranian military.
They were using it to sell crude oil and fund their operations.
Correct. The sanctions also targeted the shadow fleet of tankers that operate dark to evade detection, naming specific ships and their management companies.
And the expansion of enforcement to third-party service providers is a crucial detail here. It seems like a new level of aggression.
It is. The State Department designated Strasslink Pete Ltd., a Singapore-based firm, simply for providing pilotage services to Iranian tankers. That sends an unmistakable message to every third-country company, insurers, shippers, logistics firms, that even facilitating small parts of Iran's trade will now result in sanctions.
It significantly tightens the noose on Iran's ability to export crude. What was Iran's immediate reaction to this?
The reaction was immediate and nuclear-focused. This economic pressure coincided with a U.S. and European resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, demanding transparency. So Iran retaliated.
Yep.
They officially terminated the Cairo Agreement, which had been this tenuous technical lifeline, enabling some level of monitoring and inspection of their nuclear facilities. The termination removes that last vestige of cooperation,
which significantly increases the risk of proliferation.
And moves the entire conflict onto a much more volatile, potentially kinetic trajectory.
Moving to Africa, we saw a really unconventional diplomatic move, the G20 boycott, and a clear strategy of coercion by absentia aimed at the host country, South Africa.
This is truly unprecedented diplomatic theater on the world stage. The White House confirmed that no high-level delegation would attend the G20 summit in Johannesburg.
And the stated reason was the alleged persecution of white Afrikaner farmers.
A narrative that Pretoria fiercely rejects as interference in its internal affairs. Press Secretary Leavitt publicly rebuked the South African president for suggesting the U.S. might participate, confirming the boycott was absolute.
But the U.S. isn't simply choosing not to show up. They are actively trying to neutralize the effectiveness of the entire forum while they're absent.
That's the coercion part. South African officials reported that the U.S. sent a diplomatic note asserting that no G20 leaders' declaration could be issued without U.S. consensus.
So they are demanding veto power over the final statement while refusing to even be in the room.
Exactly. It effectively paralyzes the forum. It prevents the Global South from advancing its agenda on critical issues like debt relief, financial reform, and climate finance. It's a foreign policy that views these organizations not as arenas for collaboration, but as instruments for asserting dominance or obstruction.
We also saw the administration leverage foreign policy to directly address social and religious issues. This involves potential sanctions against Nigeria.
This is a significant move. It demonstrates the administration's willingness to use its economic leverage to compel specific domestic protections in other countries. The U.S. is considering sanctions against Nigeria to compel greater protection for Christian communities.
And the concern stems from violence and, crucially, the enforcement of Nigeria's severe blasphemy laws.
It does. In 12 northern Nigerian states, blasphemy is a crime punishable by execution. The U.S. argument is that these laws violate fundamental religious freedoms. By threatening sanctions, the administration is linking trade and aid directly to human rights outcomes.
A classic transactional policy.
Aimed at compelling behavior change in line with U.S. priorities on religious freedom.
In terms of military posture, the Department of Defense announced some significant institutional changes.
Internally, yes. The Army announced the downgrade of the Army Materiel Command, AMC, from a 4-star to a 3-star command. This is part of the Army Transformation Initiative.
Why target AMC? That's the massive logistical and supply chain headquarters for the entire Army.
It is, and the strategic rationale is to prioritize combat formations and field units over these massive, entrenched logistical headquarters. By reducing AMC's prestige and autonomy, the administration is signaling a shift in resources and focus toward lethality and frontline capability.
The belief being that the support establishment had grown too large and bureaucratic.
Right. It aligns with the broader war on bureaucracy ethos sweeping the government. But it risks short-term logistical readiness by de-emphasizing that critical supply chain command structure.
And we also saw strategic arms sales notified to Congress.
The Defense Security Cooperation Agency notified Congress of two key sales to bolster NATO allies. First, the sale of FGM-148F Javelin missiles to Bulgaria, enhancing their anti-armor capabilities.
And second,
the sale of precision guidance kits for artillery to Denmark, which upgrades the lethality and accuracy of their ground forces. These are classic transactional moves. Fortify allies who purchase U.S. equipment.
And finally, a clear focus on decoupling the defense industrial base from reliance on China.
The Department of Defense awarded $29.9 million to establish a domestic supply of gallium and scandium,
which are critical for advanced military hardware.
Essential for advanced radar, missile guidance, high-performance electronics. And given that China currently dominates the global supply chain for both, this investment is a direct execution of the national security strategy to ensure the U.S. defense industrial base can function independently.
Now let's move to the heart of the federal government itself, the agencies and the people who staff them. November 20th saw major institutional friction and upheaval, particularly in the federal workforce.
And that workforce is fighting back through the courts. This friction is manifesting through a rising wave of union litigation aimed at preserving long-standing protections.
Let's start with the Bureau of Prisons, or BOP, and the American Federation of Government Employees.
AFGE Council of Prison Locals 33 sued the BOP over the agency's cancellation of their collective bargaining agreement, their CBA. They alleged the decision was a form of retaliation masked by a broad executive order claiming national security needs.
And the BOP director claimed the move was about giving you more.
He did, but the union says the immediate consequences for employees are devastating.
What specifically did employees lose the moment that CBA was canceled?
Union officials noted the immediate loss of critical protections, specifically the right to union representation when facing workplace issues. For example, in a harassment case, the union previously had the right to investigate and represent the employee. Without the CBA, that protection evaporates.
So employees are now forced to navigate the HR system alone.
Which has a huge chilling effect against reporting issues. The lawsuit is seeking an injunction, arguing the cancellation violated the First Amendment and the Administrative Procedure Act.
The second major piece of litigation involves the National Treasury Employees Union, NTEU, and they're targeting the administration's efforts to convert career employees to at-will status.
Under the new Schedule Policy Career Classification, yes. NTEU sued the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, for failing to respond to a Freedom of Information Act request, a FOIA request, filed back in August.
And OPM just ignored it.
Completely ignored it. The union urgently requested documentation identifying which specific career employee positions were being targeted for conversion.
Why are identifying those targeted jobs so crucial right now?
Well, the NTEU national president said they need to identify as soon as possible which federal jobs are being targeted so we can do everything we can to stop the reclassifications. This is about safeguarding the merit-based civil service. The underlying policy is basically the old Schedule F, making employees easier to fire and hire based on political loyalty.
So the FOIA lawsuit is the union's attempt to force transparency and see the scale of the threat.
Before the policy is fully implemented, yes.
Now we come to one of the most sophisticated examples of administrative statecraft we've seen in this 48-hour period.
It's an exceptional tactic.
The strategic maneuver designed to effectively dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, using a technical legal loophole.
Right. So the administration nominated Stuart Levenbach as CFPB director. Levenbach is an OMB associate director focused on energy, a highly unusual background for a consumer protection role.
But the critical detail is that the nomination is not intended for Senate confirmation.
That's the key.
So if they aren't trying to get him concerned, why nominate him at all?
It is a pure Vacancies Act loophole maneuver. Budget Director Russell Vaught has been serving as the acting director, but the Vacancies Act clock limits an acting appointee to 210 days. By nominating Levenbach, who is Vaught's subordinate, the administration legally suspends that 210-day clock indefinitely.
Indefinitely, until the Senate formally approves or denies the nomination.
A process that could take years or never happen at all. This allows Vaught to stay as acting director indefinitely while he continues his plan to shut down or diminish the bureau.
So it's a way of installing a hostile leader to dismantle an agency without Senate consent indefinitely. And Vaught has a parallel strategy to cut the CFPB's funding.
That's the 1-2 punch. The White House plans to defund the CFPB by interpreting the Dodd-Frank Act in a new, aggressive way. Historically, the CFPB is funded by the Federal Reserve, which insulates it from congressional fights.
But the White House is now arguing that the Fed has to be profitable to legally fund the CFPB.
Exactly. And the key financial context here is that, due to high interest rates, the Federal Reserve has been cash flow negative since late 2022. The administration is now arguing there is no profit, and therefore no money to legally give to the CFPB after December 31st.
And they're just adopting this hostile legal reading as the government's official position.
They are, turning a legal challenge against the government into the formal position of the government.
We also saw physical changes happening at federal facilities, reflecting this drive for consolidation, specifically at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland.
NASA is rapidly advancing a plan to shrink its suburban Maryland campus by 25% by 2037. The initial phase is fast-paced, closing 13 buildings by March 2026.
And the union is raising severe concerns.
The IFPTE, yes. They're concerned this process will empty or displace nearly 100 labs and lead to the discarding of unique and valuable labs, equipment, and materials. They argue it's waste disguised as efficiency.
And the union pointed out that some of this work was expedited during the recent government shutdown.
That's a critical detail. They said they were unclear if these activities violated the Anti-Deficiency Act. They reported instances where employees were recalled from furlough and given only 48 hours to pack up their offices under threat of their personal belongings being thrown away.
Amidst all this, OPM is clearly focused on molding the future executive leadership to align with the new agenda.
OPM announced the launch of the Senior Executive Development Program, SEDP. This is a targeted, administration-driven training initiative to ensure that senior executive service officials, the highest ranks of career leadership, can implement the president's specific agenda successfully.
So this is basically a replacement for the old Federal Executive Institute.
It is. The FEI focused on generalized leadership and ethics across administrations. The SEDP signals a deliberate shift away from that toward training focused explicitly on executing the current administration's priorities. It's about cementing political alignment at the highest tiers of the bureaucracy.
Finally, within the workforce structure, we have to address the overwhelming stress facing career employees who are looking at retirement.
It's a bureaucratic nightmare unfolding, just as massive retirement waves are hitting, especially the one on December 31st. The new online retirement application, ORA, system is causing significant confusion.
And HR departments are just overwhelmed.
They are, and they're struggling to support this new, complicated digital process. The first problem is that many agencies cut the old retirement estimator, so retirees can't even easily check their years of service or estimate their pension.
So the bottlenecks start before the application is even submitted.
And then the ORA process itself is complex. It can take 2 months before the application even reaches OPM. And once it hits OPM, processing times are increasing dramatically. Retirees are waiting months for their interim pay to convert to their full pension.
So for listeners contemplating retirement in this period, what practical financial advice are experts giving to bridge that income gap?
Financial advisors are issuing urgent warnings. boost cash reserves now. To do this, many are suggesting employees reduce their thrift savings plan, TSP contributions, for the rest of the year to increase their immediate take-home pay.
And for those under 55, who face a penalty for early withdrawals.
Advisors are suggesting they consider a TSP loan of up to $50,000. It avoids the penalty and provides the liquidity they need to bridge the gap before their full pension starts. It's an incredibly anxiety-inducing financial tightrope walk.
We've covered institutional friction, policy acceleration, and workforce stress. Let's turn now to the economic data and the long-term future of government.
The long-delayed September jobs report was finally released after the shutdown. The data showed 119,000 jobs added, which surprisingly outpaced expectations.
But the unemployment rate went up slightly.
Correct. It ticked up to 4.4%, the highest since October 2021. However, wages were up 3.8% over the past year, which continues to slightly outpace inflation. The numbers are mixed, but the political framing was deliberate and singular.
What was the White House's explicit framing of that job growth?
They applied a strongly nativist lens to the data. Caroline Leavitt explicitly emphasized that the job growth went to American-born workers instead of illegal aliens.
It's a deliberate rhetorical move.
To position aggressive border enforcement as an explicit economic boon for the citizen workforce. It validates their America First agenda as essential economic policy.
And despite the White House saying that prices are down due to deregulation, affordability remains the central economic concern for most Americans.
It is the administration's political kryptonite. And countering that deregulation approach, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib introduced the Economic Dignity for All agenda,
which tackles the affordability crisis through direct government intervention.
Right. It includes things like the Baby Bonus Act, a one-time $2,000 payment for newborns, and the Boost Act, a new tax credit for working-class families. It's a direct philosophical clash with the administration's policies.
While the government grapples with all these immediate changes, there is parallel work being done to imagine a completely redesigned federal apparatus for the future.
Yes, the Federation of American Scientists' Future State Initiative. This is truly fascinating work. They conducted a project imagining what the U.S. government could look like by 2050. They moved beyond incremental fixes to designing government from scratch around core values.
And despite these wildly different utopian end states, what were the surprising common ingredients that emerged as necessary for a functional future government?
The consensus was striking. Across all the different visions for 2050, participants agreed the future government absolutely needs a more flexible workforce. It requires a fundamental shift toward outcomes-based contracting in procurement.
And what about data and service delivery? That's where many government systems currently fail.
They agreed the system demands far better and more seamless data accessibility. And most critically, service delivery must be completely redesigned to be frictionless and proactive. The government should anticipate your needs, not make you file complicated forms.
One specific and critical takeaway focused on the current heavy reliance on outside contractors.
Yes. A key conclusion was the priority of insourcing, significantly reducing the reliance on contractors and strengthening internal federal staff expertise to manage and design systems. This is seen as essential for restoring public accountability. It's a massive philosophical challenge to how government has operated for the last two decades.
Finally, we must acknowledge some notable social policy and service victories in this period, particularly concerning veterans.
Absolutely. The Department of Veterans Affairs assisted a record number of nearly 52,000 formerly homeless veterans with permanent housing in fiscal year 2025. This is the highest number the department has ever tracked in a single year.
And organizations are stepping up to help veterans manage the economic uncertainty that impacts them disproportionately.
The Disabled American Veterans Group, DAV, is highly active. They announced a nationwide virtual job fair for November 25th, and they're hosting the Patriot Boot Camp in February 2026, an intensive training program for veteran entrepreneurs and military spouses.
As we synthesize this exhaustive list of actions, what does this 48-hour period tell us about the current state of governance?
What stands out is just the immense velocity of the transformation mandate. The administration is systematically executing a clear, unified agenda of disruption and energy dominance. They are fusing executive reorganization with swift legislative victories to lock in these structural changes quickly.
And yet this acceleration is meeting intense, coordinated institutional resistance, specifically from the judiciary and through union litigation.
That friction is absolutely critical. The D.C. National Guard standoff is a definitive litmus test for the future of civil-military relations. Judge Cobb drew a very clear line in the sand, but the administration's reliance on the 21-day stay and the pending Supreme Court case suggests a calculated confidence that the higher courts will ultimately defer to them.
Internationally, the shift is away from multilateral cooperation and toward blunt economic and diplomatic instruments.
The doctrine is clearly defined. Allies are those who transact, adversaries face aggressive economic strangulation like we see with Iran, and diplomatic coercion like the G20 boycott. The traditional nuance of diplomacy has been replaced by aggressive economic and political statecraft.
The actions taken, from restructuring the DOE to dismantling union contracts and neutering agencies like the CFPB, all point toward an apparatus that is more centralized and less constrained by previous institutional norms.
Absolutely. This entire 48-hour period illustrates a government actively deconstructing established bureaucratic norms and attempting to replace them with a model centered entirely on executive control and rapid resource exploitation. The speed of change is the key weapon.
This raises our final provocation for you, the listener. We've seen this aggressive expansion of executive power met by immediate legal opposition and entrenched bureaucracy. Given the immense speed and strategic complexity of the administrative maneuvers deployed, the CFPB loophole, the 21-day stay, the rapid DOE overhaul, will the chaos of the appeals process and the high velocity of administrative change ultimately neutralize these radical transformations, or will the sheer momentum permanently embed this new structure of governance before the courts and Congress can deliver a final, binding, and enforceable judgment?
A critical question for the future of the American state, where the speed of policy implementation might just outpace the speed of judicial review.
Thank you for joining us for this granular deep dive. We'll catch you next time.